Afternoon. You've got Living Raiders on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Cody Walker here in the studio with me. Cody, thanks for coming down to the station today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's so fun to hear that song, too. I chose songs that I thought that make me happy. So I'm already happy. I can't wait for the rest.
Oh, I'm so glad. We've got Jason behind the glass. Thanks for choosing the songs for today's program, Cody. And why the Mountain Goats? Why that? And yeah, because as soon as you heard it, you were glad that Jason led with that one for the hour.
That particular song, I played that again and again and again during 2020 and 2021, these hard years where I just felt like I am going to make it through this year if it kills me. And it is a song that makes me happy and a song that I put, kind of on repeat at times and would not exactly write to, but I would, when I was writing, I was in a writing residency in early 2021 up at Goodhart in Northern Michigan. And I remember just playing that song again and again and again and again. This is January of 2021. So I'd made it through 1 year, but there was another tough one ahead.
Oh goodness. And it almost feels like, we're in another of these years to
yes.
make it through and
yes.
And to see what's coming and hopefully to build community and be resilient.
I hope so.
And maybe to, you know, go for a drive, like for a drive, you know, if the open road sometimes feels really good, the wind in the hair type
mm-hmm,
of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But Cody, again, thanks for coming down today because I realized when we had Poetry Town and you were part of the Poetry Town group. That
I come here every 2 weeks. That's just my deal. I'll be here in a couple more weeks. Just
so not
get used
next,
to me.
Not next week,
no,
but
no.
thereafter, right?
I need a week off.
But I just realized, I was like, Cody Walker, you need to get down here so we can talk for an hour, have an hour conversation. So thanks for being able
to fit
Living Raiders in. And so the book's on the table with us, The Self-Styled No Child, Shuffle and Breakdown, and The Trumpiad. So The Trumpiad was 2017.
Mm-hmm.
So the most recent, The Self-Styled No Child, also by the same press, Waywiser Press,
mm-hmm.
out of the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
I was thrilled to notice that this book was published in Cornwall. I looked at where the book was made because these are beautiful books, Cody.
I love Waywiser. They're fantastic, fantastic press.
How did you find Waywiser Press? Because they're based in the UK and in the US.
Exactly, yeah.
How did they find you?
Well, I found them for sure. They were running they still run a contest. I believe it says it on the cover of this book, the Anthony Hecht Poetry Prize, which they've had for the last 20-ish years, maybe 22, something like that. And so I applied, not really the right word, submitted a manuscript to them for a couple of years running, and I was a finalist each year, but wasn't chosen. So after the second time I was a finalist, I wrote to the publisher, Phil Hoy, who's the loveliest guy in the world, and said, you guys seem to like my stuff well enough. Would you be interested in just seeing this as a regular submission outside of the contest? And he said, sure. And then I sent it in and, you know, waited however many months and then got some happy news and then have been with them ever since.
Oh, it's a valuable thing for poets to have a press.
Oh, really, really,
because it is a type of relationship,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
Yep.
What's it been like for you with Waywiser? Because then after Shuffle and Breakdown, the first book, mm-hmm. then the second two books there too.
Yeah. So the self-styled No Child came out in 2016, and that was lovely as well. And I just had everybody I worked with. I was I felt really supported. I felt like I was in a community of, you know, sort of like-minded folks.
Their mission is amazing on the website too.
Oh, they're so lovely. And so what happened, which was kind of weird, was that this book, Self-Styled No Child, came out in 2016, and I was reading from it in Baltimore. And
your birthplace?
My birthplace. And I was reading a bunch. I'd been writing a bunch of poems about Trump because it was 2016, and, you know, what else was I going to do? So this was
brave of you.
So this was in the summer. I thought he was going to lose, and I. But I was just reading poems, just sort of as larks, and but a lot of them at one bookstore where one of the press's editors was, you know, in attendance, and then the election happened, and I. The day after the election, once the results became clear, my publisher, Phil Hoy, wrote to me from the other side of the Atlantic and sent his condolences on behalf of all of Europe to America and said, geez, you've got a lot of poems about this guy, right? Do you want to try to think about putting them together? And, you know, I was just kind of disconsolate that whole day, but there was a tiny bit of me that thought, huh, did I just get a book contract on this terribly dark day? And so then Phil and I talked about it more, and we decided to make it, run it as a fundraiser for the ACLU. So we put the book out on the 100th day. We just had the 100th day of the second Trump administration a few days ago, but on the 100th day of the first administration is when this chapbook came out. And it was, you know, it does not cost much. It's sold out now, but it only cost $6 back when it was available. But we raised about $3,000 for the ACLU, which felt like something. You know, everyone was just trying to figure out something to do. And it gave me something to focus on during a time when I needed something to focus on. So that's the story of that, you know, kind of third book. Falling, you know, or following close on the heels of the second. So that was early. So this book came out in Self-Styled No Child came out in March of 2016, and then the Trumpiad in, I guess, April of 2017.
And for the Trumpiad, did you work with the poems that you already had? Like, you spoke about how you would read them for fun, like sometimes, or because that seems like that would have been almost harder to do once, like you said, you were. Disconsolate, did you say, or desolate?
Yeah. Both, all those things. Yeah, really, really bummed.
Bummed.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So the answer is both. So this book is divided into two sections, and my brilliant publisher has Trump's very small hand with a finger up for section one, and then two hands with fingers up for section two. And the first section I wrote almost all of before the election, and then the second section, those are post-election poems and kind of just jokey poems about cabinet members and a few darker poems at the end, which I...
Do you use the humor, Cody, as a way to reckon with life?
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
Because it feels that way in the self-styled No Child, too.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's sort of the only way I know how to approach this stuff. But sometimes sometimes I'm writing something which is almost akin to light verse, although in my mind not completely in the light verse wheelhouse, but maybe adjacent. But other times I'm using light verse forms. Clara used limericks, double dactyls, Mad Gardner songs, things like that. But I'm using them, I hope, for, you know, kind of serious ends, or I try to kind of present the music of these forms, or the form makes you think you're about to have a good time, and then you're not going to have a good time because of the subject matter. But I like that tension.
Yes. Yeah. And why do you like the tension? Or, like, what do you see as that being necessary?
Yeah. I mean, I like feeling that I'm pulled in two directions at once. I mean, in almost anything. So certainly with poetry, and in a way, I feel like this has become almost a gimmick for me or my shtick, but to try to seem that I'm writing, almost light verse, but then, you know, writing about the, you know, the coming autocracy or whatever it might be. And trying to, you know, in a way you could say it's sort of pulling the rug out from somebody. You give them some expectation, then whoops, you're not going to get that. And is that interesting? I feel like it usually is. But again, it's probably a trick I rely on too much.
Well, when you say that, like, does that mean you're looking for something different because you see that's a way that what you gravitate towards? And I should let everyone in on this too, because we've got these three books on the table here with us. But then Cody also has a sheaf of new pages, which is the coming manuscript too.
Yeah.
So is that something that's in tension for you now? Like this way of working or this way of being in the world as a poet and then thinking about this new manuscript? Or do you feel like this is a way of working that's still just intrinsic to who you are right now?
Right.
But what do you, I don't know.
No, it's a great question. I mean, so a little bit of both really is the answer. So I have this new manuscript that's probably not quite finished, but it's sort of inching in that direction. And what I didn't want to do with the new one is to just rewrite these earlier books. And I feel like the first couple of full-length books, they're kind of similar. They're poems about relationships. They're poems about kind of half-joking poems, sometimes riffing on literary stuff. They're poems about death. There are some formal similarities between them, and that goes for the Trumpet as well. They're different, and maybe the first book, Shuffle and Breakdown, has a lot of Whitman in it. The second book, The Self-Styled No Child, has more poems about gun violence, has more poems about my children, because they were being born around that time, one of them before and one of them just around, well, both of them before, actually. The Trumpet, it's all about Trump. So the new manuscript.
And that I should call like a chapbook.
Yeah,
too, right?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So that's kind of its own thing. But so with the new book, I'd had, the poems I'd been writing since 2017 and I spent some time when I was listening to The Mountain Goats again and again in early 2021 and putting together a manuscript really for the first time in a few years. I put one together. I liked it, but it felt similar to what I'd been doing in the past. And then I got a fellowship a couple of summers ago at the Institute for the Humanities. And I pitched it to the folks who were, you know, choosing among the applicants as a kind of a time where I would sort of put a bow on this manuscript and especially spend some time with these Mad Gardener song stanzas that I've been writing incessantly, which are the poems that go, he thought he saw blah blah blah, that blah 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 blah, he looked again and found it was a blah 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 blah, he said blah 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 blah, and you kind of fill in the blahs, and I've been writing hundreds and hundreds of these poems. And so that was sort of my project. And then my father died right before this fellowship started, in a way that was not wildly unexpected. And he had had a good long life, but I didn't expect it right then. And I just kind of pivoted and spent that whole summer writing poems about him, mostly in a different mode, not entirely in a different mode, but mostly in a different mode than I'd been writing formally anyway. And then along the way, before that and since then, I've also been writing about my mother, who has had Alzheimer's for a whole lot of years and is alive and, kind of has pleasures in life, but doesn't know who I am and lives in her own orbit. So the more I've been writing about my parents in these past few years, the more the manuscript feels like it's taking a different shape. And again, some of that's formal. But a lot of it's just kind of, I don't know, I mean, just thinking about generations and thinking about time passing. And when I was walking over here, I was thinking, what is my theme in all my books? It's the fact that time passes. Amazing! Who would have thought of that? I am the first. But even more so maybe lately. Oh.
Cody, let's take a short break and then we'll be back. On Living Writers today, Cody Walker is here. We've got two books and a chapbook on the table with us. The Self-Styled No Child, Shuffle and Breakdown, The Trumpet, All Out with Waywiser Press. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass, and we'll be back.
No! No!
Welcome back. You've got Living Raiders on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Cody Walker is here in the studio. Thanks for picking Prince. Thanks a lot, Cody.
Oh, so fun to hear. Yeah.
I know. It makes you want to go out dancing like almost immediately, I think, right? Okay. So before we get back to the conversation and to hearing some poems from Cody, some new poems, I'm going to read Cody's short bio out of the self-styled No Child, the back of the book here. Cody Walker is the author of Shuffle and Breakdown and the co-editor of Alive at the Center, Contemporary Poems from the Pacific Northwest. His poems have appeared in the Yale Review, Parnassus, Slate, Poetry Northwest, the Heck Prize Anthology, and the Best American Poetry. His essays have appeared online in the New Yorker and the Kenyon Review. He lives with his family in Ann Arbor, shout out to the family, where he teaches English at the University of Michigan. And we'll fill in more bits and pieces of your bio and your present story. For example, directing Bear River at Camp Michigania.
Uh-huh.
And also, you direct the creative writing program.
The undergraduate creative writing program.
Mm. These are big things here, and with bringing more poets and writers into the world at a time when I think we need them.
Oh my God, we need them so much. We need poets and we need lawyers. So I tell my students, be a poet or be a lawyer, one or the other,
or both.
Both is fine. Yeah,
Kristen was in the minor in writing program a couple of years back, and she is a poet and in law school now.
Oh,
so there are some out there. And so before the break, Cody, we were talking about your time as a summer fellow at the Institute for the Humanities, mm-hmm. here, and having that time. It came because of something in your life, the death of your father, and I'm so sorry. And you had a space of time there, and a place to write work and meeting with colleagues.
Yep.
Was it something about that time and space that also allowed you to think differently about what you wanted to do next?
Yeah, I think so. I really, really loved being there. And so we got together with the fellows a couple times a week and shared work and ate food. And that was lovely. But what I probably most valued was just the time in my office alone, and I could stay there as long as I wanted to. I could and did take naps on the floor, on the hard carpet, and then I'd wake up and I'd write some more or just kind of think about things. And I didn't, I could just stay there all day. I didn't have any place I had to be. It didn't have much stuff in it, so I wasn't distracted in the way that when I'm home, there are a million things to do.
Or in your office work.
Yeah, my work office.
Because your work is sort of, your University of Michigan schoolwork is sort of always pressing.
I associated with students dropping by and all that. So this was a space that was really just designed, at least for those couple of months for me to write poems or think about poems or revise poems or move poems around on the floor or the shelves or things like that.
Did you tape things up on the wall, Cody, or anything?
I didn't tape things, okay. but I used the floor space, and I used there were a lot of bookshelves which I didn't really need, so I used those for poems,
yes.
You know, to spread them all out. And I really, yeah, I used every inch of space.
And sometimes if you move a poem around and it's next to
difference.
Someone, like another, next someone else, well, another poem.
But it is like that. No, I mean, because I talk, you know, I direct the capstone program for the undergrads, and they're just in the past month have been putting together manuscripts, and the poets, that's exactly what we talk about. That these are, I mean, I tell them, print these out, put them on the floor, move them around, because you'll see, you know, which ones want to be neighbors with others and which ones want to say, I need to stay far away from you, and which ones are, you know, kind of just need to be in an entirely different zip code altogether and aren't going to make it into this manuscript. And I feel like you can understand that better when you can just eyeball them all on the floor or the shelves or whatnot rather than scrolling on a screen. So I was really happy to do all that, but I was also just happy to think about what had been, what remains, I suppose, a complicated relationship with my father, and write, 20-ish poems over a couple of months, and, you know, 16 or 17 of which I could imagine, you know, finding their way into this new manuscript. So I have a few of them here if you'd like me to read a couple. I'll tell you what, I'll read what I imagine is the first one and the last one in the series. Does that seem good? Okay, so this first one has one of those titles that just flows into the poem. It's called On the 14th Day of Spring, My Dad Became. On the 14th day of spring, my dad became the moon. We talked as we were meant to talk, body to body, glowing. God, we were funny. A couple of moon men yucking it up. I thanked him for, get this, my life. That's how we rolled that evening in the preposterously named town of Havre de Grace. My dad had just inherited so much time and space. He was enormous at midnight. Laughter couldn't contain him. Reticence couldn't contain him. He had me, his chronicler, and his mother Anna in the role of Stardust, and the damp April air, and the whole Susquehanna, which he lit like a reading lamp. So that's the opening poem of the sequence, and I think it's the first one that I wrote. I wrote these kind of in the order that they seem to want to finally fall. And then the last one, so my dad's name is Bright Kilpatrick Walker, and depending on when people met him, they called him either Bright or Pat. So he was Pat, short for Kilpatrick, until he was, I think, 37. And then after he got divorced from my mom, he changed his name, as people sometimes do, or at least reverted to, you know, his first name. So,
and Bright is such an amazing
name.
And I think I've noticed in your writing, like in one of the first poems in the self-styled No Child, like, mm-hmm. and you read it, well, I think at the sound check you read it. I loved the phrase sparklet.
Yeah. And Cradle Song, yeah. So this plays on that. So the poem is called The Bright Dark, or just Bright Dark. And again, plays on my dad being named both Bright and Pat. Bright Dark, for Bright Kilpatrick Walker, 1937 to 2023. Today, we welcome the Bright Dark, the contactless pat on the head. Today we're dead. Next week we're trying something new. It's hard to get a read on things without you. It's hard and not so hard. Attend the mute bard. Attend the blind seer. We're a band of running walkers standing still. We look harmless. Our looks can kill. So that's how I imagine that suite of poems ending.
Thank you, Cody.
Yeah.
When you say a suite of poems, what is the number that you are? Because you said you maybe have 16 now already, or is that including the poems that are more about your mom as well?
So those would be the poems about my dad.
Those are the what you focused on during the residency.
Exactly.
Or the fellowship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It felt like almost a residency because I was sleeping on the floor.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. There's. There's nothing wrong with that to take a nap. I think that's very healthy and good. But also there's nothing like having a space that's like a separate space to see something new in.
Yeah, for sure.
It was a residency, mm-hmm. definitely.
Yeah.
So you also were, so let's get in the time machine a little bit. Let's go to Seattle back in the mid 2000s.
Yeah, both of us.
That's right. I was just leaving, but you were actually becoming a writer in residence at the Hugo Huts back when, Hugo House, a creative, it's a nonprofit literary arts center in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And for a time, they had a couple of tiny cottage or small cottages.
Yeah, tiny. Tiny is right. Yeah. 440 square feet, I think.
In Belltown, mm-hmm. which became a place of like enormous high rises and wealth during those kind of those years and thereafter. And they called them to acknowledge the small space of it, a hut.
Uh-huh.
So the Hugo Hut. And so you were there writing, was it for 2 years?
Yeah,
Cody,
yeah. I was
as
there
a writer
for,
in
yeah,
residence.
2 years. Yeah, 2006 through 2008. And I loved living there. So yeah, as you said, it's right in the midst of all those, you know, kind of semi-obscene Belltown sky rises. And it's in a pea patch, and which was lovely. And
because it was a community garden.
It's a community garden, yeah. And they were, I think 440 square feet is right. I'm going to get the date wrong. I think 1912, maybe 1912 cannery cottages.
How did they survive this long?
If we could go back in time, I'd better be able to tell you the history of them. But they were battling folks who, as you could imagine, wanted to raise that space and build, you know, multi-million dollar kind of towers into the sky, and they kept winning those battles. So the hut stayed. I was there for a couple of years. Had kind of minimal responsibilities at the Hugo House. I would meet with people occasionally, and I'd, you know, as writer in residence. But really, I was just there to kind of write and live for. They charged me some kind of pittance. I think it was $200 a month, which was kind of, it wasn't even called rent. It was something else. But it was, I mean, you know what it's like to live in Seattle. So to have your own house for $200 a month and with, you know, all utilities paid and everything else, and just to have this beautiful weird space.
It's so close to the water.
It's
so close to
the
crocodile.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, all of that. Exactly. Could walk to see a baseball game. I mean, it was really, I could walk to a gazillion coffee shops where I wrote most of Shuffle and Breakdown. And I was looking through this book with the other day and just thinking, I wrote this in Java Bean and this in blah, blah, just kind of like tracking where I, you know, kind of where my headspace and also physical space was back then. But it was just, I loved living there. And I don't know that I'll ever love a house or a hut like I loved that one.
Mm. And did you also teach when you were at Hugo House? Like they have classes for community members
I
to
did.
Take.
Yeah. So I was in Seattle from 1997 to 2008, and I went there originally to do a PhD in English Lit, which I did, but I was kind of faking like I was in the MFA program the whole time I was there. Several MFA programs, because it took me 7 years. But I so I was.
But you had already been in an MFA program
did,
in Arkansas,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So I had an MFA, but I just audited all the MFA classes at UW while I was taking PhD classes and slowly writing my dissertation. And so people thought I was an MFA student there through several cohorts probably. And,
they're like, this guy's still here.
Yeah, I know, exactly. And I had fantastic mentors, Richard Kenny, Heather McHugh, Linda Beards, people like that. And I just made friends for life. I still kind of consider that my less in these last few years maybe, but just for a long time I've thought of that as my writing community, even though I've now been in Michigan for a number of years. And I was teaching at University of Washington, I was teaching at the Hugo House, I was teaching in the WITS program, the Writers in the Schools program, and I was, you know, I worked for SAM, the Seattle Art Museum, a little bit, curating some writer's series, and just was sort of in my yes mode, where I just wanted to say yes to everything.
Oh, and you were the poet
busy.
Populist.
And I was a poet populist for a couple of years as well. Those same last 2 years when I was at the Hugo House. So I was, I was busy and it was fun. I loved being there. And when I left, I just thought, oh my God, what am I doing? But
why did you leave, Cody?
Because I got this job. Well, actually, no.
Here at Michigan.
Well, that's not totally true. I left because I got a 6-month fellowship in the Berkshires at the home of Amy Clampett, who's this fantastic, lovely writing residency that everybody who's listening to this should try to apply for, because it's a really, really beautiful space, and they give you 6 months and they pay you and you just write. And I wrote a lot of started the self-styled No Child there, title poem included. And then I was in Brooklyn for a little while with my partner, just a few months, applying for jobs. Then I came to Ann Arbor. So there was a year between Seattle and Ann Arbor, which was that 6 months in the Berkshires and 4 or 5 months in Brooklyn. But I was, I was looking to get a job, essentially.
I see. So it would be where the job would be where you would go.
Exactly.
And
thank God it was here, because, I mean, I came close at some places that I'm very happy not to live in.
I'm so glad you landed here too, Cody.
Too.
And Polly.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
And the girls. Okay.
They came a little later, but yes.
Yeah, exactly. I know, they're Ann Arborites, actually, right?
I was thinking about coming here and talking about having been here for 15, 16 years, but I still kind of feel like the new guy in some ways, but and I'm sure that'll go away eventually, but my kids are Michiganders through and through,
yes.
So it's a different feeling of landing someplace in your 40s versus growing up here.
That feels like it's a poem coming too. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back. Today on Living Writers, Cody Walker is here. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
I may seem young, perhaps naive. With all my wandering, when all the old women with gray in their hair tell me mistakes are the only fair to get where you really want to go. I can't say that I often see clarity, unless I'm looking at the grass, the window panes, the alley cats. I'm getting where I really wanna go. Yes, I'm getting where I really wanna go.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're right in time. We're at the halfway point here with poet Cody Walker here in the studio with Jason and I today. And you've got Living Writers here. Thanks for being here this afternoon, too, in the spring that we're having. Lovely May. So, Cody, thanks for picking the songs again for today. What was this? Why this song?
Yeah, so that last one was Bea Truxell, who I hope I'm saying her name right. The only reason I know her, and I love her songs, is because of the great, great poet Carlina Dwan, who maybe was on
a Wolverine. Not yet, but I hope she comes on.
Yeah, should be on this show at some point. I mean, just a fabulous, fabulous, fabulous poet. And I think it was Carlina's 30th birthday. I'm going to say, was it a year ago, a couple of years ago? She had B play at her at this backyard party, and I bought her CD, and it just ended up in my car. I didn't take it out for 6 months or something, and especially this one song, Getting Where I Really Want to Go, I just love, love, love. So I'm really, really happy that Jason found it and was able to work that in. It makes me happy.
Aww. Well, all of this is making me happy. I'm glad you're here, Cody, today, and that you all found your way to Ann Arbor.
Yeah,
because you've also lived lots of places, because you've had like we at the top, like near the top of the program, it was mentioned that you were born in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. You've also been, let's see, you got your MFA in Arkansas. Where did you do undergrad?
Mostly Wisconsin Medicine, although I took a detour to New College in Florida, which back when I was there,
oh my
was just,
goodness.
I know.
Okay, Cody, because this is actually very timely.
Yeah, for people who don't know about it, New College, when I was there, was the coolest hippie school in the world. And
cooler than Evergreen.
Yeah.
Washington.
Exactly. And
or as cool.
Maybe, yeah.
I don't
actually,
know why I was trying to
I actually
to
moved
be
to the Pacific Northwest because my partner at the time wanted to go back to Evergreen. So I love Evergreen.
It's
but it's
a school where you create your own path. There aren't pre-existing majors. And I don't think there's grades.
No, they're contracts. That's right. And so I was there when it was great. And
imagine that. I'm glad many of the students have already gone. Otherwise,
know,
they'd be probably like, why isn't this the school?
So it was taken over by Ron DeSantis and Christopher Rufo and other.
Literally taken over.
Literally taken over, yeah.
The university president was removed.
Exactly. So it's just become this, the 180 degree opposite of what it used to be. And
faculty were fired, right, Cody?
Yeah, fired or just left. Because
others had to leave.
The mission became so different. So it's really. It is not what it was, but it was fantastic in the late 80s when I was there for a year. And
why'd you leave? Or time to keep moving on?
I fell in love with somebody who I still love who's my dear friend, whose birthday is today. So shout out to Rachel Wolf, 58 today. I talked to her earlier this morning.
Oh, happy birthday, Rachel.
So Rachel, we had to get where we needed to go. We drove around the country a bit and wound up back at Madison, where I'd started. You're right. But since then, I've lived in Thailand for a year. I lived in Korea for a year, Seattle for a bunch of years. And so landing in Ann Arbor and more or less having stayed here now for the last going on 16 years is weird, because I used to always have this sense that I didn't even want a job that was a commitment more than a year or something, because I wanted to be ready to go on to the next place. But that's not the case now. Now we think about the timeline. Polly and I think about it in terms of our younger daughter, Ani. Well, she's 11, so we should say
a writer, Polly Rosenberg, who's also is a friend of the show.
Yeah, absolutely. He's been on the show. And so we think about our timeline in terms of Ani going to college. So that's 7 or 8 more years, we will definitely be in Ann Arbor and, things like that.
And everybody knows Ani from 2 weeks ago.
Yes, Ani, the poet, of course. Yeah, Ani, age 11. Exactly. I'm back here as Cody, age 58.
Yeah. And I guess we should also say that it's interesting that the University of Michigan president is now going to the University of Florida.
Yeah, he's getting where he really wants to go, which is a lesser university.
it just seems like there's a plan for Florida.
I think so. Yeah,
that was
yeah.
started with the cool new school becoming not so cool.
Yeah. No, yeah. it was awful, awful, awful to follow that. I wrote a little piece about it that I said at some department gathering, and what did I call it? It was a coup, essentially. I don't think that's the language that I used, but basically, a college being flipped on its head. Mm-hmm. Really sad.
So let's hope nothing like this is ahead in store for
yes,
us.
Yes.
With the power vacuum at the moment.
Yep.
So good luck to us all.
Yes.
Okay, so Cody, let's mm-hmm. get back to the poems.
Yeah.
Could we talk for a moment about Amy Clampett, where you had the residency in the Berkshires?
Of course.
Because I think one of the poems that I read in the self-styled No Child had, I think it was two sections. It's just so interesting to see your poems on the page. I love that. And reading them aloud versus reading them in your head.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, you feel like the movement and the lyrical mushing. Pushing you forward.
Yeah.
But there was one where it said Amy Clampett was like in the West Village.
Mm-hmm. Right,
so
right, right.
It made me think, how come I haven't really read her before? And I was so interested to see like the people who she's, it just shows my gaping area of ignorance in her life. But it seems so interesting that she had this life in New York and then began writing poems, which people would say like a late bloomer.
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
And then being compared to Elizabeth Bishop, among others, mm-hmm. as like her, the people in her like poet crew.
I know she got recognized late, and partly because of Mary Jo Salter, who identified her when Mary Jo was very young. And I think maybe, was she reading for the New Republic then or the Atlantic? I'm not sure. But then Amy Clampett's poems started to show up in those journals and also in the New Yorker. And then if I could go back kind of like Seattle, if I could go back in time, I would know this timeline much better. But what happened with Amy Clampett is that she bought this beautiful kind of Cape Cod, small but beautiful house in the Berkshires when she was, you know, maybe late 60s, I want to say, and thought she'd lived there for a long time with her husband. And then she got cancer and only lived there for a few short years. And her husband then turned over the house to, I think it's called the Berkshire Taconic Foundation, to use for this writing residency that's now been, kind of going for 20-ish years, maybe slightly more than that. And it's just, I feel like it's the best residency in the country in terms of the length of stay, how beautiful it is, the fact that they pay you while you're there. And they really just leave you alone and say, you know, have a great time. And
do your work.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, Cody, for you as a poet, is that something that, well, because you also have a family too, is that something where maybe going to residencies is useful sometimes because it's a prescribed piece of time
so
that you can plan for?
It used to be something that I would apply for various residencies like the Clampett Fellowship or Sewanee's a little bit different because that's more workshop based, but I had one at the in Tucson, at the University of Arizona. I had one in Vermont that was really useful. And I just love the headspace and to be away from my stuff and all of that. And again, just being able to put poems on the floor and figure out what goes where. So when I was at the Poetry Center in Arizona, I kind of really put together this first book, and it was at the beginnings of, I think, my second book in Vermont. But now with kids, it's hard to do. So if I'm going to do something like that, it really should only be for a week or two. So the idea of taking a month or, you know, God forbid, 6 months like the Clampett House Fellowship was, not really possible now. Maybe someday, but these days I just write on the couch for the most part. Sometimes
and,
in coffee shops,
and
mostly
sometimes,
on the couch.
And plan things on napkins.
For sure. Yeah. Yes.
Well, I'm sure also like these experiences that you've had and will have again,
mm-hmm.
it must influence how you see Bear River. Like you're, like directing Bear River, which is a program for writers to come. Is it for 1 week, Cody, or is it 2 weeks?
It's not even a week. It's four days. I mean, parts of 5 days, I suppose. But so the session that's coming up will be over Labor Day weekend. So it'll begin on the Thursday before Labor Day, and we get together on Thursday. We have 100 participants, a dozen-ish faculty members. We begin
and
with
faculty come from all over.
They
right?
do, We've got fabulous faculty from all over the place. Some with Michigan connections, some without, and we do a big reading on Thursday night, and then Friday morning dive into workshops, and Saturday workshops, and Sunday workshops, and along the way we have faculty readings and craft talks and participant readings at the end. So it's busy, but to get back to your question, it's also a time where people are generally away from, you know, whatever, you know, kind of pulls them away from writing. So they're, whether that's family or a job or other responsibilities, and they're in a cabin and they can write, and they do write. It's a generative workshop, so they have to write. I mean, they get pitches and prompts, and they have to go, you know, sit down and type, 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 and then they report back later in the day or the next day or at the Sunday reading. So it's one of the things I like, and this is, you know, going back to Keith Taylor and folks who ran it well before I was there, but the way it was set up as a generative conference really does differentiate it from the Breadloaf or Sewanee or other kind of models of workshops, you know, conferences like that.
I love that.
I really do too. Yeah.
It feels so like Hugo House to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So yeah, we're doing it over Labor Day weekend. We're full at the moment, but if anyone's listening and interested in getting on the wait list, we usually do make it through the wait list. Sometimes it's at the very end. Like we'll contact you 3 days before the conference begins and say, somebody dropped out. Do you want a spot?
Yeah, but you never know with life. Yeah, the flexibility is
so
good.
Don't be afraid of the wait list. We do usually make it to more or less the end of the wait list, but yeah, but we are full, as we pretty much always are at this time each season.
That's okay. So that's Bear River and everyone. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Today on Living Writers, Cody Walker is here in the studio. I'm T. Hetzel, and we'll be back.
Somebody shut the door. I knew where temptation lies inside of your heart.
You can talk during this.
I know where the evil lies inside of your heart. Well, get out of here. If you're gonna try to make it right, you're surely gonna end up wrong.
Wrong, 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 wrong.
Oh, well, shut the door.
Ah!
And it's only 8:45. I know, right?
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason Adam Voss behind the glass. And today, our guest, the poet Cody Walker, is here. So, Cody, would you read us a poem from the self-styled No Child out with Waywiser Press?
I will. Yeah, thanks. So I'll read this poem called The Garden. And this is, it's a three stanzas that are in the Mad Gardener's song stanza form that I stole from Lewis Carroll. And Lewis Carroll wrote in this form just 9 times. They're scattered throughout this Sylvie and Bruno is a book he wrote after the Alice books that's not really that great. Nobody reads the Sylvie and Bruno books.
I've never heard
of
this.
Yeah, they're not they're not terrible, but they're not fantastic. They're odd. One thing that's great about them is that they have these stanzas interspersed, and he wrote 9 of them. The last one is the best. I think I can do it from memory. It goes, it's actually really because of the Pope being chosen, maybe as we speak right now, or maybe tomorrow. It's perfect. Perfectly
conclave.
Timed. But yeah, conclave. So it goes like this. He thought he saw an argument that proved he was the Pope. He looked again and found it was a bar of mottled soap. A fact so dread, he faintly said, extinguishes all hope. So that's the final one. And I think it's unimprovable. I've never written one that I like as well as I like his, but he only wrote 9. I've written about 350. So
that's what I was going to say. You've got hundreds.
I beat him in quantity. So here are 3.
And this counting.
Yeah, exactly. So this is called The Garden. And this is sort of what I was saying before, that almost my shtick, I suppose, of using light verse forms to talk about non-light verse matters. So in this case, well, you'll hear. The Garden. He thought he saw a cancer cell divide itself in 2. He looked again and found it was a note from Vita Blue. You can't go back in time, it read. So brief, so sad, so true. He thought he saw the singing moon reflected on the water. He looked again and found it was his 18-month-old daughter. I'm not sure she can swim, he said. Perhaps a druid taught her. He thought he saw a Charleston church exploding in the night. He looked again and found it was just that, in black and white. A coward's at the wheel, he said, and held his children tight.
I know, Cody. That is a poem that you do not expect how painful that gets to that historic moment, and you do it so well.
Well, thanks. I mean, that's, again, I love the form, but I don't really love light verse. I don't love things doing what you think they're going to do, I suppose, is a better way of saying it. So so I write in light verse forms, like I said, but not always or often to try to primarily be funny, even though I know there's an edge of funniness to them.
There is. And it's interesting to also get to hear you deliver, too, because there's a way you have to use your voice in a way that if somebody else was reading them, they might be caught up in some different sing-song that you resist as you deliver.
I used to do a lot of readings at the Hugo House, as you can imagine, when I was a writer in residence there, and also when I was the poet populist. And I have a friend, Jason Whitmarsh, a fabulous poet who still lives in Seattle, who would just laugh so much at my readings because I would read stuff that sounded like it was going to be funny but wasn't. You know, it was about 9/11 or something. And then I'd read them, and people would kind of laugh, and I would say, don't laugh. And it was just Jason would just love those moments where I was just kind of staring down the Hugo House audience who didn't quite know what to do.
But maybe it was also a release for them.
I think there's that
recognition of the darkness.
Something is in you and it has to come out in some way, laughter or tears or whatever it might be.
Yeah. Hey, before we don't move on past Seattle, you had mentioned WITS, the WITS poem and Writers in the School.
Right, right.
Did you want to talk about this briefly?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So I taught, when I was in grad school in Arkansas, I taught a lot of Writers in the School's sessions, gigs for the 4 years I was there. Loved it. When I went to Seattle, then I signed on as kind of about as full-time as you could be as a writer in the school there, which meant having a couple of residencies at all times. It's still not a full-time job there, but it was. I did a lot. I loved it. And I used to walk. So the poem I brought with me is one from my Arkansas days, and I used to share it with the folks in Seattle, and then also with my students, my undergrads, even my grad students. And so this is a poem that was written in the early 1990s by Rochelle Emerson from Hot Springs, Arkansas, Bill Clinton's hometown. And she was then age 8, so I guess now she's 40 or something.
Amazing.
But it's my...
If you're listening.
It's maybe my... Yeah, Rochelle, this is for you. It's maybe my favorite poem in the world. The Half Man, Half Frog. It's a prose poem. The half man and half frog argued and argued. The frog wanted to go one way. The man wanted to go the other way. See, the frog wanted to sit on a lily pad and ribbit. The man wanted to go to a cafe and eat globs of potatoes and ribs. So finally the frog said, I think we should let you go eat today, and tomorrow I'll sit on the lily pads. You mean I have to sit on a lily pad? Said the man. The frog said, oh no, not again. And you just get the idea, this poem and this conversation just goes and goes and goes and goes and goes forever. And I'm pulling this from some year-end report I wrote where I wrote that it strikes me on a par with Kafka's Parables and Paradoxes. And so I said yesterday evening to my literary modernism class and blah, blah, blah. But just love the sparks that come out of, age 8, age 11, as we heard here 2 weeks ago. Things like that. So I've loved that work over the years and don't do much of it anymore, but miss it a lot.
Hey, this is a weird question, but you mentioned your thesis. Like, what was it like looking at that again after some years?
Yeah. So I was, for people listening, I was telling T that this morning, I didn't have that much to do today, so I brushed up on myself, which meant
reacquainted.
I read my older books, and I looked at my PhD dissertation, which was on theories of laughter. So when you said relief or release a moment ago, that's the third theory, right? There's the idea that we laugh out of a sense of superiority, the idea that we laugh out of a recognition of incongruity, and the idea that we laugh out of some kind of relief or release that is like a steam that needs to come out in some way or another. And I was looking back on all of the ways that I sort of tracked those theories and then sort of added my own idea of the difficult laugh, which kind of is somewhere between a laugh and a gasp. And it was looking at poems that sort of created that effect. So that's what I was doing at the Westgate Library.
What a cool dissertation, though, Cody.
It was fun to do, and it was I had not looked at it in years, so it was fun to look at again this morning.
Well, let's hear a poem. From the new manuscript.
Okay, so this one kind of this has been a hard season for older men in my life and Polly's life recently. So this is a poem that I wrote just a couple of weeks ago. It's called "It's Springtime and Dads Are Dying." It's springtime and dads are dying. They're crumpling in parking lots. They're dispersing in crematoria. They're imbibing drug cocktails. See, death with dignity. See, my stepdad. They're saying, coach, sub me out. They're saying, somebody, cover my shift. They're done with summer and fall. It's springtime, and all the dads are dying.
Thank you, Cody.
Yeah, so that's just from a couple of weeks ago. Maybe that will be in the new manuscript. It's not a poem I wrote along with those other poems for my dad or in conversation with my dad when he died a couple of years ago, but it seems sort of in
conversation with
conversation.
Those,
yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And could we hear another poem too, Cody? Because we're coming up at our time. So it'd be, I know you said you wanted to maybe read the one that you wrote about the radio too.
Oh yeah.
But we.
Well, why don't I tell you what I'll do two quick ones. How about that?
That sounds good.
So the
and then we'll say.
I'm gonna find it if I keep looking. This is one I wrote for my mother, and I've been watching a lot of basketball recently, and I was also 4 years ago. So this is called September. It's about the basketball playoffs, sort of, but it's really about my mom. And the reason it's September then was because of the bubble season and COVID and the fact that the playoffs didn't begin until September, but the Heat were playing the Celtics. And I was thinking about my mother, who, as I said, has Alzheimer's, and there's a little bit of Alice in Wonderland in here as well. So September. Jason Tatum, I don't hate him, nor do I hate Bam Adebayo. My mother, stay with me, is from Ohio. She doesn't follow basketball. She doesn't follow much, and that's a fact, says the Duchess. Jimmy Butler once more touches. The Heat fall. It's my mom's last fall, maybe. She once held me like a baby. This poem's been hacked.
I love how that moves around in so many places, Cody. Yeah. Whew. Let's read that last one because I want to make sure we get it in before
we have to.
I mean, we could talk about
that. Yeah, the last one, very different, but it's...
But this is because you were just here
2 weeks
ago.
I was here
2 weeks
ago, and I was writing a poem every day in April, so this was my poem that day. It's called Earlier Today. Earlier today, Ani and I were on the radio. A time-traveling knight interrupted, saying, "My lady, oh, a word, please." I said, "Dude, we're on air. Wait for the break." Later, Ani and I stopped at Sweetwater's and shared a chocolate milkshake. Some of that poem is true.
Thanks, Cody. Thanks.
Thank you.
And is that something that is like part of who you are as a poet? Some of that poem is true.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Often I'll just follow the rhyme, so the rhyme will take me to whatever place I'm going to go to, and I am happy for it to be true-ish or not true at all. But we did have a chocolate milkshake at Sweetwater's after we were last here, and who knows, maybe again tonight.
You might recommend it.
I definitely recommend it. Best dessert in town is a Sweetwater's chocolate milkshake.
Oh, well, Cody, thanks so much for your poems, for your new poems today. It's so exciting to hear the new work. That's so lovely.
And thank you.
I'm so excited for the coming manuscript and what happens next. Also, to get to see these books with Waywiser Press, such a cool press, the self-styled No Child Shuffle and Breakdown, and also your chapbook, too. Cody Walker, thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Tia. Really, really appreciate it.
Oh, anytime, Cody. Come back anytime. It's been long overdue. Thanks to Jason for engineering. Thanks to all you out there for listening. Hello, Mom. I'm Tia Hetzel. Until next time.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper.
standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of
that oompa sound. You know what time it is, friends and family. It's time for polka. Yes, you get a bonus 30 minutes of the Drive Time Polka Party this evening right here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. My name's DJ Ish, and I'm sitting in for 30 minutes of what would have been the Daily Sports Report, but our intrepid team is off for the summer. So, in lieu of some sports ball talking, we're gonna do a little baseball polka. Enjoy.